On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film The Greatest Showman. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, as it's mostly lighthearted and we talk about a whole bunch of other stuff. But if you do proceed without having seen it, just be aware that there are a couple of minor plot spoilers. Enjoy. Now we're recording. Okay, do that thing again.
Paddy Justin, this is the moment you're waiting for.
Nice. I thought that was just going to go into one of our old band songs. I have the guitar on me because I was just jamming while I was waiting for you.
Oh, very nice.
I've been listening to a lot of Rush this week.
Oh, really?
How do you feel about Rush?
Rush, I think I missed the boat on. A lot of people got into Rush when they were sort of in their mid to late teens, I think, where they started getting into the more like the complexities of music and rhythm and things like that. And Rush are one of those bands that a lot of people get into at that age for their sort of proggy, rocky elements. So I kind of missed the boat. But whenever I listen to them, I'm like, oh, yes, I can appreciate this. This is good music.
It's very good music. And despite it being definitely complex for the sake of it, you know, it's still very, very catchy. You know, they're yeah, the David Foster Wallace of guitar music.
There's some really nice hooks in Rush songs, I find. It's not often that you get bands that are kind of proggy in nature but that still have interesting choruses and catchy choruses.
Yeah, like you can sing parts of a Rush song, whereas, you know, other progressive groups, I don't know, I couldn't sing you a line of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, should we say?
No. Try and sing me a chorus of a Dream Theater song.
I really like Dream Theater.
I think the mark of a good prog band is if they're able to successfully merge like progressive music into traditional music so that they can properly intertwine the stupid proggy elements with the stupid poppy elements.
Yeah.
So you look at like King Crimson, and like Court of the Crimson King is one of the all-time greatest albums of all time.
Yeah.
I realize I said all time twice then. It is because it's relatively late at night and I'm feeling a little bit fuzzy in the head.
It is. This is the latest we've ever recorded in the day. So yeah, they're all a bit sleepy. But I haven't been sleeping that well recently.
Oh no.
So I was going to try out some sleeping pills tonight, but research has been published this week that suggests that sleeping pills make you racist. So I thought maybe I could try some, and then we could see how racist the podcast gets.
In case you didn't know, Paddy, any medication makes you racist. That's just the way that it works. And I'm so glad that Roseanne has been able to bring this up for us. Because, you know, I was on antidepressants for over a year. And I'm so glad that I can finally come out and say that when I was on antidepressants, I basically became a Nazi.
Yeah, I remember the Nazi phase. Yeah, we all tolerated it.
People tolerated it, but it wasn't spoken about because we just didn't know that medication can turn you into a racist piece of shit.
Yeah. Those asthma inhalers that I have, they've been making me vote UKIP.
just muttering remarks about the Portuguese under your breath every time you inhale. Yeah,
under my wheezing, sleep-disturbing breath.
Roseanne is terrible. Roseanne Barr, you're terrible.
I don't even know who Roseanne Barr is. Who the fuck is she?
She's in the show Roseanne.
That's some old American sitcom that I'm sure I have no interest in ever seeing.
It was an old American sitcom that was relatively well liked because it talked about a working class white family at a time when most sitcoms didn't talk about that. And in general, sort of, it's not an area that sitcoms generally looked at. And so in that regard, it was quite, it was well respected at the time. It got brought back as a revival show last year, or was it earlier this year? I don't know. In spite of the fact that Roseanne herself has become more and more mental over time, And there was lots of comments at the time saying, do we really need a Roseanne revival, particularly when its star is so so dysfunctional and so blatantly racist? And it turns out, no, we didn't need it. And in spite of its incredibly high ratings, ABC has decided, you know what, we're not touching that anymore.
Good for them.
Yes, and it's a shame because a lot of people are going to end up losing their jobs over this. But it's because the star of the show is a massive racist. And if technically you're employed by Disney, you can't get away with being a massive racist.
No.
Not anymore, anyway.
What they could do is, I don't know, maybe, just going to put it out there, they could retain all of like the crew and all the other non-racist people who worked on the show, get someone else who's funny, start a new show with a non-racist, and just like assign all those people to that. I don't know, just a thought, just an idea.
I'd watch that. I'd watch non-racist Roseanne.
Yeah. So it would still be Roseanne, but it wouldn't be Roseanne playing Roseanne. It'd be someone else.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've all lost out on the chance of, you know, such important episodes of a sitcom as Roseanne decides to spend the entire runtime of the episode insulting survivors of a school shooting, which I'm sure was going to happen in season two.
Yeah.
Or Roseanne camps outside a pizza parlor that she believes has some kind of rape gang working out of its basement, a basement that does not exist.
Roseanne's crisis actors featuring Prison Planet Pool.
Roseanne lets it sink in.
Oh, his tweet about Tony the Tiger this week had me in absolute hysterics.
I absolutely love it.
He is beyond a parody of himself.
I absolutely love these kind of people because, in particular, they seem to look at the left wing as the be-all and end-all of the nanny state and of political correctness and stopping freedom of expression and freedom to eat as many frosted flakes as you like and everything like that.
Yeah.
But historically, particularly in the UK, those kind of decisions to stop people from doing things like that have always come from the right wing, which is their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So it's really funny seeing this strange divergence of Prison Planet saying, we've got to stop this liberal elite from doing this, when at the same time saying, we shouldn't stop our kids from eating Tony the Tiger cereal as suggested by the Conservative government. It's like, one of these things is not like the others, Paul.
Yeah, his real name is Anthony the Tiger.
Speaking of people who don't go by their real names, have you been enjoying all of the stuff about Tommy Robinson?
Oh, geez, that guy. Is he actually in prison now?
I don't know.
Where he belongs.
I hope his prison is actually on the surface of the sun.
Because
that would be great.
He is genuinely a violent criminal.
He's a total bellend who now, for the second time, has nearly led to a mistrial, so people who deserve to be in prison have got off scot-free. That's why they're stopping him from doing this. It's not a freedom of speech issue.
Yeah.
It is the fact that if he keeps doing this, there could be a mistrial and genuinely dangerous people might get off. Let the justice system do what it wants. Stephen Christopher Yaxley Lennon, which is your real name.
Your name is not Tommy Robinson.
Let that sink in. In quotation marks, Tommy Robinson, as that is not your real name.
Yeah.
Your real name is, and I repeat for our listeners, Stephen Christopher Yaxley - Lennon.
Interestingly, Yaxley was the name of one of the minor Death Eaters in the Harry Potter series.
If one person's
going to be... I'm not saying there's a connection.
If one person's going to be a Death Eater, I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah.
It's Tommy Robinson.
He is an evil racist. And speaking of evil racists, The Greatest Showman is a film about P.T. Barnum, who was something of a racist himself, should we say. have you ever seen a picture of P.T. Barnum?
He looks like
He's monstrous. He looks like a boot.
He does look like the villain from a Victorian set horror movie, doesn't he? He really does. I was going to say, Paddy, that you know that we're recording this rather late in the day.
Yeah.
You could say that this is the latest show.
Do you want to go to the latest show? See, it's been like almost 2 weeks since I watched it, and I've actually forgotten most of the songs apart from the big one, which was always on the trailers. Little bits of them come back to me, but yeah, the big one, look out, because here I come, and I'm marching on to the beating bum. Like, I keep that, I think, is a very, very catchy song, and it was kind of in my head before watching the film. But the rest of them haven't stayed with me in the same way, although I do look back on it, thinking these are good and very stirring, mostly emotional, good songs, but they haven't stuck with me in the same way. Have they done that for you?
Yeah, I think I've got a confession. I managed to avoid pretty much anything about this movie in terms of seeing footage of it until we watched it this week. The first time I listened to one of the songs from this was at a drag cabaret show, which I went Excellent. To on Friday night, where they opened to the Greatest Showman theme, and that was the first time I'd actually heard one of the songs from this, and I was like, this is cool. I think I'm going to like this film. The film itself, not as good as the drag cabaret show. It did not have a drag queen doing the song that Jessica Rabbit sings from Roger Rabbit. Ergo, not that good.
I mean, how can you top that?
Exactly. I mean, that was one of the highlights of the entire stag do that I was on. It's a shame that it doesn't have that in it, but it is an enjoyable movie, I'd say.
I forgot you went on a stag. How was it?
I did do a stag. It was very good fun. It was very nice. Got to go abroad. It was based just outside of Barcelona.
Beautiful.
In a town called Sitges. And it was very nice and I had a lovely time. And then I came back to the UK and saw that the gammon had been at it again. And thought,
Yeah, you just open your phone. All you need to know is the gammon are back on their bullshit.
Yeah.
That's it.
I got my first hint of it when a Spanish person just went, no, jamon. And I thought, realised, uh-oh, it's the gammon.
Yeah.
The gammon are at it.
There are a lot of the gammon move to Spain, don't they? And call themselves expats instead of immigrants.
Well, I think quite a lot of the expat community aren't as Brexity as it may appear. Because I think a lot of them realise, oh, wait, if we leave the EU, things might become difficult for us.
Yeah.
But there are exceptions like Nigel Lawson, who was in the news today because he was trying to get French residency after Brexit, despite being one of the main voices of the Brexit campaign and one of the biggest proponents of Brexit as a whole.
And a man who named his daughter after himself, but just feminized the name.
Yes.
That's not weird and pretentious and up its own ass.
Definitely not. Oh dear.
I find it hard to connect Nigel Lawson and Nigella Lawson in my head because she's so wonderfully wholesome and a great cook and has good recipes, and he's just an evil gammon. Like what happens at Christmas? Gammon.
He cooks up an evil gammon. She cooks up the evil gammon.
There's no turkey in this house because we're not letting turkey into the EU.
It's got two rashers of bacon on it facing down like angry eyebrows, and then a mouth that's made out of a sausage link. And Nigella turns it towards her father and says, look, Dad, it's you. And then there's 50 minutes of awkward silence as they carve into the ham version of Nigel Lawson's head and eat it.
I'm liking that the dark turn that our podcast has taken, recording after 10 p.m. Yeah, don't cry after dark.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Gammon visions.
Gammon vision.
I was thinking that, but I was too tired to start singing it. I got all my energy out on that burst of The Greatest Showman singing.
Oh, there we go. I don't think I'm going to be able to remember any other songs from The Greatest Showman, so I might just have to keep bursting out into the core theme every now and again. So
there's a bit where it goes, "This is the greatest show," and there's a bit where it goes, "Look out, here I come," and there's a bit where Hugh Jackman asks if you want to go, but it's not clear where he's asking you to go
to the maybe, greatest
maybe it's
show.
Just like, oh, okay, not just like round the back for a fag by the bins.
I thought you were going to say round the back for something else entirely there, Paddy.
Well, that too.
I mean, since it's Hugh Jackman, fine, mate. I'm in.
Yeah, he's handsome, isn't he?
He can show me whatever he wants in his magical tent. apart
he's
from
incongruously handsome, as we discussed, P.T. Barnum, a real kind of rugged, weathered cliffside of a man. If you ever look at the pictures of him,
I do find it funny that someone looked at a picture of P.T. Barnum and thought, you know who'd be perfect to play him? Handsome man Hugh Jackman.
That's the thing. The whole like idea behind this film is so utterly ridiculous. And if it wasn't for the genuinely quite good pop songwriting and a really good, I think, understanding of how to write a popular zeitgeisty musical that the musical side of it has, it'd be one of the most contemptible, awful films, and it would have been, you know, it would have been treated worse than something like The Room, for example. But because it has that element of it, it gets away with it, but it doesn't feel quite right, does it?
No, it still feels very weird. But I find, like, obviously P.T. Barnum was a bit of a piece of work in real life, but the sheer ridiculousness of this film kind of takes it over the edge to me, where I'm like, I don't find this problematic anymore. This is just stupid fun, and that's fine.
Yeah.
It is really dumb. It has very little to do with real life. And that it's all the better for it.
It's not a film that it's worth trying to pick apart or really analyze, or it's not worth being offended by. It's not worth having really strong feelings on it, other than that this is an all over the place complete mess of trash, and that's fine because it's entertaining.
Yeah, and if you were gonna, you could do quite an interesting biopic about P.T. Barnum, and go into sort of like the way that his ideas about race changed over time and things like that. This is not that movie. this movie is, I'm gonna put on a great show and we're gonna fight for our rights to party.
It was the film the Beastie Boys should have made while MCA was still alive.
Yes. It's very, very silly, but it's all the better for it. I think. Like if you're looking for something like an in-depth discussion about that kind of entertainment at that time, this isn't going to scratch that itch for you. If you want lots of good fun songs, then yeah, come on down. Hear some fun songs. See Zac Efron dressed as a circus ringmaster.
Yeah. And having a like weird scene with Hugh Jackman in a bar where there's just them and the exasperated barman sort of being like, oh, here they go, fucking rolling my glasses around and dancing on the counter. Get the fuck down.
he's one of my favorite little characters in this movie. I don't feel as though the sort of minor characters are as well rounded as you perhaps would want, but it doesn't really matter in a film like this. I suppose it's not as important here, where in general the plot is very much behind the spectacle of the thing.
Yeah, it's spectacle, I think, is exactly the right word. And on that kind of meta level, because it's a film about circus and about showmanship in and of itself, it has to be showy. And it's definitely trying to just make that statement more than anything else. And that is done very, very much at the expense of characterization, plot, and a lot of the things that usually make a film work. But it still manages to pull it off. I mean, I didn't like this film as much as I wanted to. I'm usually really, I'm a sucker for musicals. I'm usually suckered in. If the songs are half decent and there's a vaguely good, competent story, I'm like, yep, I'm in. I'm all over it. Give it to me. But this was just like, the plot was so absent and it was so all over the place that it left me feeling not cold, but just thinking, this is ridiculous and stupid and hilarious.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like, I didn't feel like a strong connection to it, like I did with, as we discussed one of our early episodes, like La La Land, which is the same composers as this, Pasek and Paul. So that was some of their earlier work, I guess. And I connected with that film, I think, for different reasons that we've discussed, even though it's problematic. It's a film about a white man saving jazz. But I connected with the idea of kind of dreaming in that film and having dreams and chasing them and whatever, as cheesy as that sounds. And The Greatest Showman, it has basically more or less the same message. Chase your dreams, don't give up on them, yada, yada, yada. But its characterization is very, very bad.
Yeah, and I think, like, as you know, I'm kind of conflicted about La La Land.
Yeah.
In that I saw things in there that I liked and things in there that I didn't like. I think the thing that The Greatest Showman has over La La Land is that I could not turn around now and sing any song from La La Land whatsoever. But I think, although I've forgotten most of the music from The Greatest Showman, those two songs, I think every so often they'll probably crop up in my head and I'll be like, oh yeah, that song was good.
This is The Greatest Show. See, I could sing you some of the songs from La La Land because I've got the sheet music book.
Oh, there we go. But yeah, there was nothing in there. Even as I was watching it, there was nothing in that film that really, really caught me.
What like, about music-wise. Ryan Gosling's face?
Well, music-wise.
Oh, music-wise, okay.
I didn't feel as though the music behind it really propelled the film as a film. Whereas here, I think, if you took the music out of The Greatest Showman, what would you be left with? You would be left with very, very little.
Yeah, a couple of very, very thin scenes about a man risking his family's livelihood multiple times and about Zac Efron and Zendaya loving each other very, very quickly with very little build-up. And one scene where she runs away because of bad racism happens, but they love each other, so it's okay. And then there's a song. So it's all fine.
Yeah, they kind of gloss over the whole racism thing, don't they? And it's interesting that they chose to make race a part of it, given P.T. Barnum's history with race.
Yeah.
And you could go either way with it, but the fact that they kind of gloss over it whatsoever, is really strange, don't you think?
Definitely. And it only really crops up in that one scene where, basically, the main romance in this film is actually between Zac Efron and Zendaya. She's a trapeze artist or something. He's P.T. Barnum's business partner who he randomly finds in a bar and agrees to go into business with, even though he doesn't need it. Fine, whatever. They look into each other's eyes and then they love each other. And then there's his parents, like, meet her once and are immediately racist to her. And then that's it. And then the next scene, they're in love and it's fine. And there are literally no more obstacles to their love. But that racism is supposed to be, the way it's framed, it's supposed to be the biggest impediment to their love. Like, that should be the story, really. But it's not, because instead it's just a collection of set pieces and spectacles thrown together with a little bit of wokeness thrown in there. And that side of it kind of stinks.
Yeah, it's weird because I don't want to get too much into the history of P.T. Barnum here. As far as, you know, you need to know is he's a very ugly man. That's the most important takeaway from this.
Yeah.
Early on in his career, he was kind of involved in minstrel shows and unsavory elements like that. But as he got older, and even then there was this like cynical thing about the minstrel shows being used to sort of like just make money. And then as he got older, he kind of became more of a proponent of black rights in the US and things like that. So he was
a complex character,
complex person, who probably deserved a more complex look at his life in a biopic than the only element of race involved in the film being around two minor characters who face a little bit of racism and then overcome it.
Yeah. No, it would not, you could not describe this film as a biopic. I think some people have misleadingly described it as such, but that is false and erroneous. It's a showy, cheesy musical that happens to be about some parts of the life of a real person. It's in no way a biopic.
Yeah, and that's kind of what makes it a bit strange, because there are real people in this movie, but as far as I'm aware, P.T. Barnum never rode into town on the back of a CGI elephant.
He certainly did not. That made me lose my shit, that scene. That is hilarious. This is the end of the film. It's like his kind of big romantic gesture to his wife after they've had some fight or whatever. Or now he's rich and it's all good and he's conquered New York or whatever. All I can remember is that he takes an elephant and rides it across town. As if that ever happened. Not that everything has to be historically accurate, but it was so overblown and so hilarious that you're just like, yeah, fine. Hugh Jackman on an elephant.
To make it even better.
He was born to play.
To make it even better, it's snowing. He's riding an elephant in the snow through New York.
Yeah.
Did he learn nothing from Hannibal? Seriously? Read a history book, P.T. Barnum. So in terms of the general plot of this movie, P.T. Barnum wants to do a show. He gets a show. It's quite successful, but it's not enough for him. His wife's like, no, it's fine. We love you and you're successful and that's enough. And he's like, no, I must go and be the best thing ever. He nearly has an affair. The press reports it as an affair. His wife is understandably upset. But he didn't have an affair. His show gets burnt down, but then he comes back again. And then he goes off to spend time with his family. And they're like, okay, you're not a cheaty bastard and you're going to spend time with us. The end.
Can we keep the elephant, please?
Can we have the elephant? Can we keep the elephant? We'll take good care of it. We'll walk it every day.
Yeah. It all just, the pace of it is very, very odd. It really, it just suddenly jumps from part of his life to part of his life to part of his life. Like every scene, it builds up some problem for him that's then just immediately cast aside in the montage into the next scene. So yeah, it's very, very, very strange.
It is weird because it almost feels like, and I'm sorry, Zac Efron, that you've not escaped this, but it almost feels like a High School Musical movie in its like tone and the way that everything is so overly produced. Like, you know how when you watch Les Mis, and as we discussed, it was all real takes. And it all felt very real, but it moved seamlessly between scenes of acting and scenes of singing. It's not so smooth here, and it all feels very overly produced. It feels very pop.
I think it's very interesting to compare it to something like Les Mis, actually, as both are musicals, both are telling big stories and using bits of their history, but they couldn't be more different. And I think the difference is that Les Mis, the music is led by the content of the musical because it's based on a novel by Victor Hugo, which tells the very, very important and highly politically and historically charged story of the French Revolution over many, many years. Whereas in The Greatest Showman, because it's cinematic, it's made to be a film and to sell on that kind of level, which is very, very different. It's not being adapted from anything. Everything else, so the content, the history, everything, is in service to the spectacle and the show.
Yeah, I completely agree. Everything here, they both come out, even though on face value, if you put the details of each movie into a computer algorithm, they'd come up as similar movies. But the moment that you actually look at the way that they were created and the reasons that they were created, it becomes that much more important to recognize how different they are. And you're right, it all comes down to what their core focus is. And the core focus of The Greatest Showman is very much spectacle. These songs and the elements of this movie, which are the best, which are the songs themselves, they're basically meant as, it's almost as though they made it with making an album in mind or making a stage show in mind.
The whole time I was thinking this would be so much better on the stage.
Yeah, and I imagine that at some point, I mean, I'm going to do a quick Google in case I've already announced it. At some point, this is going to be a stage show.
They must do, when the film eventually comes out of cinemas. Because I think even though it's on the Amazon Prime now, I think it is still going in the cinemas. And it's only been like a couple of weeks since it dropped out of the top 10, which is really, really amazing. And I was so intrigued by that as well, as I keep saying that it got to number one on its sixth week of release in the UK. And had this kind of build-up of cult following around it, and people going back time and again to sing-along screenings. And that element of it, I think, is really interesting. And I'd be interested to go to one of those screenings and see how it changes your perception of the film. Which, Mark Kermode said on his podcast that it completely changed his idea of it. He thought it was terrible the first time he saw it on some press screening room, and then having seen it with an audience who are belting out the songs. It just becomes about the songs. It's almost like a gig, I guess. But to have that experience in a cinematic setting is something else.
Yeah, exactly. And it looks as though they may well do a live show of this. Having a quick look around, it has been discussed. And if it continues to become a cult classic, if it continues to do well post-release, so if their DVD sales or their streaming services do well, I imagine that you'll see it on Broadway at some point relatively soon.
Yeah.
And the cynic in me thinks, yeah, they probably did some of it even with this in mind, because it was all framed around... The plot is not important here. It's all framed around the music.
Absolutely. And you're going to be able to sell tickets to that show. So it's a money spinner. And yeah. The cynic in me says, well, that's the capitalist entertainment world that we live in. And the people who are making it, they know that. They know exactly what they're doing.
Yeah. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with it. The songs are ridiculously catchy. I want to see them have a real elephant.
Yep.
That would be good.
Real
snow, real elephant. If the elephant kills someone, even better, because you shouldn't have an elephant locked up like that.
Yeah,
and it deserves to take out at least one of the lead actors, at least once a month. That should be part of its contract.
The elephant has its revenge. Yeah,
because elephants never forget; they hold grudges.
This is true. Yeah, that elephant has seen some shit. The stories that elephant could tell you. It's got to be the same elephant as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no
change. You can't change the elephant. You can change Zac Efron, but you can't change the elephant.
Precisely. But yeah, it is entertaining, though. I did get entertained by this film. I wouldn't necessarily turn around and say, you know what, I've got to watch that again.
Yes, I don't think I'll be watching it again anytime soon, because it was kind of exasperating how it kept jumping from thing to thing incongruously, but the songs broke it up in a nice enough way. But yeah, it's not one to watch again. But if, you know, if you're around someone's house and they're like, let's watch The Greatest Showman, and it's coming on, you're like, yeah, sure. Why not? I'm happy to watch Zac Efron and his handsome face dancing around in the bar, you know? It's all good.
Yeah, it's a fine film if you're into that sort of thing. I would not... When I watch a musical, I'm always more entertained by the passion and the vibrancy behind the performances, and that's what really sells a musical on me. A musical movie, and this is a little bit too clean cut for me. It's too clean cut in the same way that La La Land was too clean cut. When I'm watching a musical, I want it to be the same kind of chaos as Les Mis or Mamma Mia.
Yep.
Where it is just, you know, it feels raw and silly, and it all feels like it's a bit of a mess, but that passion like comes through. Whereas here, like, it's all really good, and obviously Hugh Jackman is a terrific singer on top of being a terrific actor, but it all feels a little bit too good.
It's too good for its own good.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and I think you've touched upon the real problem with this, which is that it didn't star Pierce Brosnan in the leading role.
It should have been Pierce Brosnan and Russell Crowe.
Yeah, Russell Crowe is playing the Efrenator's part, obviously. And then Meryl Streep as Zendaya. Yeah, they could have pulled it off.
That would be amazing. I mean, let's just be honest here, that would be incredible.
Yeah. Pierce Brosnan, you can picture him looking into the camera going, "This is the greatest show." With, you know, his like serious angry face on, like when he's doing the "When you go." It'd be like that. It'd be great.
It would be so great. Oh man, I wish that's what it was.
Yeah, but no, the other thing that with that comparison is that the things you said where it works are adapted from the stage. This is the interesting question then that I now put to you is, can you think of any films that were straight to film musicals where it genuinely works? Because off the top of my head, I'm struggling. Footloose?
Straight to film.
I've never seen Footloose.
Footloose is good. Mm.
Not a gotta cut loose. Footloose. This is the greatest show. Footloose has been on my list of films for us to watch, actually, but I think we need a break from musicals for a little bit.
Would you consider The Producers to be a musical? The original?
I think so, yeah. It's a highly comic musical, but there are a lot of songs in it that break up the dialogue and the action, so yeah, I guess.
Because that works well as an early example.
And was that a film before it was on the stage?
Yes, so right. The film was it went film, stage show, film based on stage show.
Because I saw it on stage before I saw it in any other format.
Oh, yep, yeah. I'd seen the original movie first, then I saw the stage show, and then they made the kind of subpar movie of it.
I haven't seen it. But it was the cast that I saw of the stage show with, so Nathan Lane, Lee Evans.
Yeah, yeah. I saw it. So the movie has Matthew Broderick horrendously poorly cast as Leo Bloom. He's terrible in it.
No,
he's really bad.
That's a shame. I always root for Matthew Broderick, you know? I feel like got a raw deal. Ferris Bueller's Day Off was so good, and then like since then, he just couldn't come back from it. And then now he's gotten a bit jowly, and all he does is pop up in the background of films like New Year's Eve.
Yeah, he's very, very poorly miscast in it. Uma Thurman is also kind of miscast, which is a shame. But Nathan Lane is Max Bialystock in the movie version as well, yeah. And he's fantastic, as you'd expect, because Nathan Lane is amazing. The other one I can think of is Moulin Rouge, which I don't particularly like as a film. I don't really like Baz Luhrmann all that much.
I'm glad you said probably that because isn't gonna... I do not care for Moulin Rouge either. I've only seen it once, but I just didn't get it at all. But I think...
I apologise in advance to all of our listeners because lots of people love him, but I just can't get on board with his directing style. It just doesn't gel with me.
I think... And that's, is this going to be what they call on the Twitter sphere an unpopular opinion?
It might be. It might be.
I think his Romeo and Juliet is very good and very enjoyable and a very interesting take on Shakespeare. But yeah, overall, I'm not sold. Open to him, but not sold. I'm a Lerman agnostic.
I didn't particularly like Romeo and Juliet, but I respected it for doing something different. Moulin Rouge I didn't really like. I didn't actually mind his Great Gatsby adaptation,
though. Actually, I did like that.
I thought it got the spectacle incredibly on point. I think that the darker scenes should have been a little bit darker. The whole thing had this kind of mysterious feel to it, this kind of otherworldly feel, which I don't think quite worked.
Yeah.
But when it was showing off the lavish fake life of Gatsby himself, it did it really well.
It was incredibly well cast as well.
Yes, yeah. I quite like The Great Gatsby. I thought that was a very good film. But yeah, Moulin Rouge, a lot of people think is great. So that is another one that, you know, straight to film.
Yeah. And it's not dissimilar to The Greatest Showman. I bet you all of our listeners who love Moulin Rouge also love The Greatest Showman. Please write to tell me that I'm wrong.
I imagine that's probably the case. so there's been a fair few. You've got, I don't know if Little Shop of Horrors was that a stage show first?
A stage show first, but I honestly have no idea.
You've obviously got Xanadu, the greatest film of all time. Have you ever seen Xanadu?
No.
The Olivia Newton-John musical that was a huge financial flop.
Sold. I'm in. Is it the sci-fi thing?
It's the most 80s, unbelievably 80s thing you've ever seen in your life. It's more like fantasy, kind of.
Cool.
It's like a sort of fantasy 80s thing. It's really silly. It's really good fun. But yeah, I think you're right that a lot of it stems from, a lot of them do stem from stage shows, because that's where the musicals really took hold as time went on. And that's where you get a consistently high level of musical entertainment.
Yeah, and I think people have been trying for such a long time to translate that into film, and I don't know that. I think we're at a high point, the highest point now of that working that we've ever had in the history of cinema, because this is a great success. La La Land was a great success. There's a few others that I can't think of, but I'm sure that are out there of good examples of musicals working on film. But I think I'm always fascinated by how difficult it is to adapt musicals into film, and how I don't know that any one film has completely nailed it yet. Apart from Russell Crowe bellowing for 3 hours in Les Mis, obviously.
And I think part of our idea about musicals not quite working in or historically not working in cinema is probably down to the era in which we grew up and the films that we grew up watching, because the 90s was a real lack of good musical movies, particularly good like original musical movies, whereas you had a fair few in the 80s, in the 70s, in the 60s, and then you've got more coming up now in the new millennium. But those 90s years, which were the most formative years where we were watching films, they really weren't that many around.
There's no equivalent of Grease, is there? Grease, I guess, was so huge at the time.
Yeah, exactly. There wasn't a movie of that ilk that had anywhere near the same like success or iconic nature when we were growing up, which in turn might be why we don't necessarily connect as well with The Greatest Showman, because we don't have that history of watching films like that, I suppose.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, in the 90s, all we had was the Air Bud cinematic universe. So, you know. And interestingly, that's a thing that The Greatest Showman does have over La La Land, is a direct link to the Air Bud cinematic universe, in that Zendaya has appeared in, I think, multiple Air Bud films.
Really? That's incredible.
Yeah, she was one of those Disney child stars, wasn't she?
Yeah. So she was in...
I don't think... She's not in Seventh Inning Fetch, which is obviously the best one, because it's the baseball one.
I can't believe that there is... I mean, that you know, if you can do however many degrees to Kevin Bacon, you can clearly do however many degrees to Air Bud, can't
Six
you?
Degrees of Air Bud. Yeah.
that makes me feel happy.
Yeah. Oh, no, wait.
Feel happy.
She voiced Lollipop the Horse in Super Buddies, which is one of the kind of spin-off, well, the broader Air Bud cinematic universe. The Buddies series, I'm sure you're aware of, are the talking puppies of the Air Bud franchise. It's later. It's a bit like the Star Wars prequels. We don't talk about them too much if you're hardcore into the Air Bud universe.
Okay. Have you got an Air Bud tattoo, Paddy?
Yeah, yeah. It's of a golden retriever on my right buttock.
I knew it. So going back to The Greatest Showman, I think part of the reason why it also doesn't really hold interest with us is that it doesn't feel that dangerous, and there's nothing there that really sort of like tests the boundaries. And all of the great musicals have in some way, shape or form tested something, tested the audience in a way. So when Grease first appeared on stage, people were kind of taken aback by it as a sort of incredibly adult, sleazy, dangerous show.
It's going to encourage high schoolers to drink and have sex.
Yeah, so there's all of that stuff about sort of like, you know, like teenage pregnancy. There's lots about sex in there. There's even like gang violence and things like that. Yeah,
dangerous drag racing.
Yeah,
there's a song called Mooning, so, you know, it encourages getting your ass out. It's filthy.
And so even something that nowadays you look back on and with this sense of nostalgia, even then when it first originated, there was something dangerous about it. And looking at the most sort of like the musicals that have caused the most discussion in recent years, all of them have done something a little bit different. Whether it's Mamma Mia having a cast who can't actually sing, very bold move there, very bold move. Or Les Mis having those very raw performances to get that emotion in there. La La Land being incredibly racist. I kid. The interesting thing about La La Land was the way that it had all of those incredible sets, the sets that felt almost like magical in nature, and the way that it sort of called back to those 50s musicals.
Yeah.
Which no one had done in a very long time. All of them have done something quite different, whereas with The Greatest Showman, it's hard to pinpoint anything that it does differently. It feels very safe.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not pushing any boundaries at all in any way. And yeah, as you say, going back to what I was saying earlier is about how a thing rears its head and it looks like it's a problem, but in the next scene it's just dealt with. There's no ongoing jeopardy and there's no real arc. It's just show after show after show. And that what should be the big climactic song, the look out, because here I come, that song, it should be like, there should be some momentous thing that song is responding to. But what it's responding to is that P.T. Barnum didn't let them into a party.
Yeah. And given some of the other horrible things that happen in this movie that are glossed over very quickly, you'd have thought that they put it somewhere else other than after the he's kind of let us down by not letting us into a party.
Yeah, like the thugs who burned down his circus. That happens, right? Some thugs burn it down.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's like fighting and violence and stuff. It's all, yeah, that all happens in about 30 seconds. Whereas you get at least a minute to a minute and a half of Zendaya's crying face after Zac Efron's parents do a racism to her.
Which, yeah, and that is understandably quite a distressing scene, but it doesn't feel that way because after that, it's just like flick a switch. That it's nothing feels genuine. Nothing has any sense of the permanent in this film, and I think that is its main issue. Which is a real shame because there's potential here. They had a really, really great cast together. Obviously, you've got Zac Efron, you've got Hugh Jackman. Michelle Williams is really underused here.
She's
as well.
Great.
She's a phenomenal actor.
She should have had her own like kind of huge emotional number at some point.
Yes.
She had a few little bits but didn't have like a big number. Hers should have been the showstopper. She should have had like a Don't Cry For Me Argentina kind of moment.
Yes, and it never happens. The closest you get is Rebecca Ferguson, who plays Jenny Lind, gives a very emotional sort of final performance, as it were.
Yeah.
And that's the closest you get to that kind of thing. And again, she's great. Rebecca Ferguson is really underrated, I think, in general. And puts in a really good performance here. One of the few performances that I think has a little bit of subtlety to it, I suppose.
Yeah.
There are elements where you're like, I wonder what's going on here, and you see sort of like the difficulties behind the scenes of that character and things like that. It's an interesting performance and one that I think, again, they could have done more with.
Definitely, and a good and interesting take on like the idea of bringing opera into that kind of thing and how musicals interact with opera as well, because her singing is supposed to... She was an opera singer in real life, and they talk about her being an opera singer, but the song she sings isn't an opera song, but it is operatic. And that side of it, I thought, was really interesting and quite well done.
Yeah, and again, that sort of like clash of ideals of entertainment, again, isn't really dealt with. It's again kind of glossed over as they have to keep this momentum going for a plot that nobody really cares about to get to the next musical number that people do care about. And it just almost feels as though it would have been good if they'd taken a step back and thought a little bit more about how the plot would work in this film. Because even though the musical numbers are great, having an interesting plot of some description is always kind of important. So you look at Mamma Mia, you've got ABBA songs there, aka possibly the most singable songs in the history of music. And even then, they still wanted to frame it around this pseudo mystery of who the real dad is and things like that. And you are invested in it. Whereas here, you're never really invested in that plot. And I think that's really to the film's detriment.
It's because there isn't a plot. There's no coherent arc across it. I couldn't tell you what the plot is, honestly. All I could tell you is P.T. Barnum wants to win his childhood sweetheart's hand. He does. He wants to do a circus. He does. He gathers all these people. He does it. He wants to get this opera singer woman across. He does. Zac Efron falls in love. It's very nice. P.T. Barnum needs everyone to accept him and needs to impress everyone. He has a disagreement with his wife. He rides an elephant. Fine. Big song.
The most important bit being that he rides an elephant, of course.
But it really, it's a very, very interesting exercise and a good demonstration of why plot is so important. Perhaps more so than any other element of film and of storytelling in general, is that you can hang some dodgy stuff off a plot if you've got a good plot. But if haven't got a plot and you try and hang things off of it, it still just looks like they're hanging in thin air. And I think it's also a reason why sort of crime and thrillers are so popular, because I'm not really into crime and thrillers, I mean, in terms of books and films or whatever, but they always have very, very solid and tight plots. And that's why people like them, I think, just as an aside.
Yeah. Yeah. Having a plot, I mean, this is going to sound a bit obvious, but having a plot is unbelievably important. And having that hook that keeps people engaged, because it's all well and good having a musical where, you know, they tune in every 15 minutes to the next song and then they zone out again, but they're not going to remember your movie.
Yeah. It sounds obvious to say that, but there are a lot of films that make it into mainstream cinemas that have little to no or just terrible plots as well. Plots that just don't have that arc, or don't string their scenes together properly, or where the jeopardy just isn't apparent, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think it really is something that people should take home is, hey, maybe you should have a plot in your movie.
Yeah, I mean, what's the plot of The Bridges of Madison County?
Fucking on the linoleum, crying in the rain. That's all you need, Paddy.
That sounds like good.
What's the plot of Boyhood?
Like a beat poem. The plot of Boyhood is that it took 12 years to make. Did you know
exactly.
that? Did you know it took 12 years to make?
I did not know that it took 12 years to
make.
Isn't
that amazing?
That is incredible. That is the most incredible thing I've ever heard in cinema.
If anyone should be called the greatest showman, it's Richard Linklater, right?
Given that it took 12 years to make.
What greater show is there than a film that took 12 years to make?
The 12 years to makest showman.
That's very bad.
Thank you. I'm getting sleepy now. My brain has stopped working.
Yeah, it's late in the evening. The day is almost done.
It is.
Yeah. What else do I have to say about this film? Let's see. He says New York society will never accept us, and then there's that line is never dealt with ever. There's never any element of New York society not accepting him, apart from the critic character, who I thought was actually one of the more interesting characters, and the scene when he sort of has a chat with the critic sort of further down the line, and the critic guy is sort of vaguely accepting him and understanding what the circus is, and they sort of seem to be rubbing along. That relationship I did find genuinely interesting.
Yeah, that was an interesting one, I think. And it kind of, that was one of the moments of sort of like good writing in the film, where at the lowest point they then have that glimmer of hope through the critic saying, yes, blah, 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 blah. You guys are all right. I don't despise you. Good luck. And then you're like, yeah, even the critics on board, we can do it. Of course, in real life, the critics were not particularly on board with this film.
No.
Until its metaphorical circus had burnt down.
Yeah.
I suppose. So maybe they knew all along that after an initial disappointing run, it would then gather steam and it would gain support.
It would rise from the ashes like a phoenix.
The whole thing is a metaphor for itself.
Yeah. I think the makers of it would be very, very happy with you describing it in that way. Returning to, you know, what we've been saying about spectacle and such.
Well, I'm pleased they would think that.
Yeah. So I think we're being kind to it, but it's a kindness that's deserved. It's earned it.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed this film. It's not going to stay with me apart from possibly two songs, definitely one song. But it was an enjoyable romp.
I'm glad that it exists. I'd rather that this was, you know, doing really well at the box office than Justice League, Age of Bullshit, or whatever, you know, like whatever the 15th expansion of whatever cinematic universe, you know. Or, you know, another dreary adaptation of a novel like On Chesil Beach or whatever. Kill Me Now.
Are you saying, Paddy, that you don't want another movie about sad white middle-aged men?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
I know because I am, you know, an almost 30-year-old white person, but like I don't want to watch any more films about white people who can't have sex. I mean, I kind of I'd rather watch The Greatest Showman on an indefinite loop, to be honest.
I'm with you on that. I have no interest in one of my least favorite subgenres of movie is the adaptation of a literary fiction book that critics love and nobody else has read.
Yeah.
It's one of my real, like, I have no interest in watching this movie. Get out. Because it's just like, the only reason that any of those books are interesting in the first place is if they're written in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And there's only so many ways that you can portray that in cinema. And most of the time, it's just vaguely artistic long shots of a beach. And then a close-up of Casey Affleck's face.
People walking along, talking slowly. But they always get quite big budgets and quite good actors to star in them, don't they? It's interesting, that subset of film.
Yeah, it can all get in the bin. Yeah, though.
All I want is to for the Air Bud universe to keep expanding. That's all I ask of cinema.
Okay. Yeah, I'm on board with that. Come on, more Air Bud, please.
And they can all be about baseball. It's fine. He can work his way around all of the 30 different major league clubs and save each one in a different way.
Alternatively, a Philip Roth adaptation, but with dogs as the actors.
I'd go for that. The Great American Air Bud. Philip Roth died, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
I've not read any of his books, but I have ordered a copy of The Great American Novel because it's a baseball book and I haven't read it, so there you go.
Oh, there we go. I've read a couple of Philip Roth books. He's one of those people where, yes, he fits into that literary fiction mold, but he wrote things in such an interesting way that was the point of it, and that it told these stories. So like American Pastoral, for instance, is a very interestingly written novel. Equally The Human Stain, where the way it's written is almost the point of the enjoyment of reading
it. Isn't that the new Marvel movie?
The Human Stain is the worst superhero.
Yeah.
Yeah, pastoral man.
That's just a shepherd. but yes, rest in peace, Philip Roth. He had a good run, published a lot of great books. Swirling in the Heavens tonight. I look forward to reading his work.
I look forward to the Air Bud adaptation of his work.
Do you think Philip Roth and P.T. Barnum are having a chin wag in heaven.
You're suggesting that P.T. Barnum got into heaven, buddy.
Yeah, that's true.
you're suggesting that the afterlife of P.T. Barnum is not that if you repeat his name three times in a mirror, he appears to you and then takes you off to a hell circus.
I'm genuinely very, very scared and will not be doing that.
I dare you. You've got to say P.T. Barnum three times in a mirror, Paddy.
Yeah. I'm going to
tune in next week. Yeah. And if it's just me who's delivering the episode, you know what's happened to Paddy.
If you're co-presenting with P.T. Barnum's ghost, then you know that we've got a problem.
Welcome to Ghost Cast.
Big ghosts don't cry.
Oh, dear.
Good times.
Yes. Right. Shall I move on to some trivia?
Yes, please.
So Zendaya did all of her own trapeze stunts in the film.
Wow. That's awesome.
Which is pretty awesome because that trapezing is excellent.
Hats off to her then. That's hard work, dangerous work. Someone's got to do it.
Another bit of trivia here. Rebecca Ferguson, she did not sing the songs that she was singing.
What?
Saying that although she can sing, because her character is considered the best singer in the world, dubbing her voice would be in service of the movie.
Okay, so they had to get the best singer in the world to dub it over, which was the guy from the Go Compare adverts.
Yeah, exactly. I thought I'd heard his voice somewhere before.
He's the true greatest showman.
Oh dear, I'm losing it, Paddy. I'm losing
it. Yep, me too.
So in real life, P.T. Barnum did meet Queen Victoria.
I did know that because I had to look that up while we were watching the film. I was like, did that really happen? Apparently it did. He brought all his freaks over and they hung out with Queen Victoria. Pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I would like to know Victoria's real reaction.
I hope she was nice to him.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope a little wink in his direction.
Yeah.
That's what I want from my queen. But yeah, so that'll probably do for trivia.
That's some good trivia though.
Yeah, just a little bit of trivia for you.
I like it when people do their own stunts.
Yeah, so do I.
It always strikes me as slightly Tommy Wiseau-ish, but it's great.
I really like it. I like it when people do their own stunts, and I like it when the sort of stunts and the action scenes are all real prosthetics, things like that. I don't have much time for the terrible CGI elephants, I have to say.
No. They had the money for a real elephant. Or maybe at that point they'd run out of money.
Maybe. And they were like, okay, we'll just use the remainder of our CGI budget to get them to do some elephants for us.
Or is it because, as you say, an elephant never forgets?
It's true. Maybe. Maybe someone in this movie wronged an elephant at some point and they realized they couldn't take the risk.
Or is it just like they wouldn't wish the experience of having to remember being in this quite incoherent and weird film on any elephant?
That's got to be it, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, final thoughts. My final thought is that it's I'm glad it exists. It's good in a way in that it's entertaining. It's some of the cheesiest shit I've ever seen in my life. The songs are generally catchy quite good and just about hold it together. The plot is non-existent. It is all over the place. It is a complete mess. And it's a beautiful, entertaining, cheesy mess. It's a plate of cheesy nachos.
That's a great way to describe it. Yeah.
Do you have anything to add to that?
No, I completely agree with all of that. Particularly the cheesy nachos. This is chili con queso. Mm. This movie.
Oh no, I'm getting hungry.
Although maybe not quite as delicious.
No, I wouldn't describe it as delicious.
It's like budget queso.
Yeah. You know that it's good and it's going to fill you up, but it's not necessarily a taste sensation. But there are some parts in it that are like guilty pleasure food, like, you know, American, like, single cheese, squeezy cheese on a burger or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what this is.
It's the film equivalent of American cheese.
So how are we gonna rate this? How are we gonna rate this?
Let's see. How many incongruous freaks are not allowed into P.T. Barnum's party and have to go and sing about it?
Love it. Right. I'm going for 12 freaks. 12 freaks for this film.
That's good. I think that's kind. I think I'm going to go for, yeah. I'm going to go slightly lower and give it a 10, just because the lack of any real semblance of plot was a real problem for me that just made it feel very thin, despite it having a lot of meat on those bones. There was meat, there was bones, there was no flesh, should we say, to use a slightly grim analogy. But yeah, I'll give it a 10. It's halfway there. It Bon Jovi'd it.
I enjoyed the musical sections, although they all felt a little bit too polished.
Yeah,
I enjoyed myself without ever feeling attached to anything whatsoever, and I came away from it feeling pretty good, but then almost instantly forgetting anything that I just watched.
I can't remember much of it. I had to refer back to my notes quite a lot.
But it's an enjoyable film. That's something to take away from it.
Yeah, it's fun. You should watch it.
Yeah, give it a go.
We definitely recommend it.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Cool. So what have you got for us next?
So it's been a while since we watched a classic of the 90s. So we are going to watch Never Been Kissed.
Oh, nice. I enjoy this one. This is good.
Yes, it's going to be an enjoyable watch. Yep. I look forward to discussing it.
I think we always get good episodes out of these kind of films.
Yeah, for sure.
It was, in fact, some of our friends were here earlier this week and we were playing Heads Up, you know, the game where on your phone you hold the phone up to your head and you have to name things or describe things to the people without naming them. And we did films, and that was a film that came up. And I think I tried to describe it as Drew Barrymore has never been romanced, or she has not been romanced, or something along those lines. And we got there pretty quick.
Excellent.
And then one of my friends tried to describe Field of Dreams to me as Paddock of Thoughts or something. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then I was like, it's a baseball movie. Just say baseball and ghosts and I'll get it. Oh, it's great fun. Good game.
Stuff.
Yeah, so Heads Up, if you're listening, that means you owe us money now. You're our sponsor.
Yes. Yeah, you're now our sponsor. You don't have any say in the matter.
Heads Up, Heads Up.
We like your game. Give us money.
Cool. Well, I don't think there's anything else to add. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, that is it for me.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for listening, as always. You can tweet us at BigBoysDon'tPod. Drop us an email, BigBoysDon'tCryPodcast@gmail.com. Always love to hear from you. And if you like what we do, leave us a nice rating or a review on iTunes or wherever. You know, it would just, you know, help us out. It'd help us make the case to Heads Up that they need to give us money.
Leave us a review and put it on iTunes. This is Big Boys Don't Cry.
Nice. Do you want to go to bed? Because it's late.
I definitely want to go to bed.
All right. Let's button this
up. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.